We've been kind of working through this series that goes through the last hours of Jesus' life up to his crucifixion. And today we end this portion of this series. Next week we celebrate his resurrection, but this week we culminate in the final interaction, as far as we can tell, though a couple of the Gospels suggest that there may have been one after this. But this is one of, if not the final interaction that Jesus has with a living person before his death. Friday night we'll be focusing in on that pivotal moment when Jesus' death sealed our victory. But we've been walking alongside Jesus through the beginning of the Last Supper. We've been with him in the garden. We have seen him in front of Pilate. And then last week, as he came along the Via Dolorosa to his final place called the Skull, which in Hebrew is Golgotha. And interestingly enough, if you follow me on Facebook, you'll know that I learned that the Latin word for that is Calvaria, which is where we get the word Calvary from. I literally just found out this week that was earth-shattering to me. For the rest of you non-Bible nerds, that was probably like, yay, cool, that's great, Jordan. But that was huge for me, like realizing, I just thought it was like a fancy term that we use. Like sometimes Christians use Christianese and we just make up words and we pretend like they are like these super important words. Well, I just assumed that's what that was, but that's an actual Latin term. So it matters to me, for those of you that may be intrigued by other languages or by historical meanings. Calvary literally means the place of the skull, which one of my friends on Facebook challenged me to sing some of the Calvary songs that we sing and instead say the skull instead of Calvary, which, I don't know. If you want to have some fun, just go through some of our like hymns and worship music that say the word Calvary and see how it feels to say the skull. It, in a sense, is almost more morbid. But at the same time, it is central to what we celebrate. The death of Jesus, while on one hand morbid, saves us from our own death. His death means that we do not have to have eternal death ourselves. But in the book of Luke, it reminds us that Jesus was not crucified alone. Alongside him that day were at least two others, criminals ostensibly deserving of their punishment. We know very little about them. We aren't even given their names, and we assume that there were probably more than two. You see, Romans were very efficient people. And so three executions on the day that Jesus died is probably not all that happened. The Romans were very good, especially at this point in world history, where there was a fair amount of unrest, especially in Israel. There's a good chance that Jesus was not crucified with just two others, but Scripture only tells us of two. From all accounts, these men are getting what they deserved. They were tried and condemned, and they were not willingly taken to their crosses. Last week, I mentioned that with most executions, you have to force it. Most men and women do not go to their deaths without a fight. And that's especially true of any kind of execution. And I mentioned that with crucifixion, it often take 5, 6, 7 soldiers, trained soldiers, to hold down these men as they flailed and wrestled to save themselves, even though it really was a fool's errand. In fact, these men, Matthew 27 tells us that these men were largely unpleasant. Matthew actually tells us that along with the soldiers and the crowd, the two criminals also said cruel things to Jesus. Jesus was even being humiliated by the very men that he was surrounded by. These men were angry. They looked at somebody like Jesus, whom they no doubt heard of his messianic claims, his kingly claims, and watched as their Roman oppressors nailed this so-called Messiah to the cross. Maybe they thought Jesus would be the one that would save them from the Romans. Maybe they had hoped that this Messiah would lead an army to rescue Jerusalem. And now, here was this Messiah. And remember, Messiahs are not supposed to die. Maybe these men would have been part of the royal entrance that Jesus made the week prior to his execution. Today is Palm Sunday, and many churches celebrate Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. Because of the series we're in, we're not focusing on that day. But remember, the crowd that gathered to welcome Jesus was the very same crowd in many ways that cried, "Crucify him," 5 days later. The very people that showed reverence to Jesus were the same of those that called for Barabbas to be released just days after his entry. So maybe these men were hoping that this man would be their salvation, and yet here he was beside them suffering their same fate. Maybe they were just angry that this man was clearly upstaging their own executions. Often people will be martyrs for their own cause, and so perhaps these men hoped that in their final hours they would be the ones remembered as martyrs, and perhaps they realized in their final hours that they too would be relegated to the footnotes of history. But whatever the reason, filled with anger and hate, they lashed out at Jesus. But sometime in the hours after Jesus went to the cross and said the now immortal words, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." Sometime in there, something shifted in the mind of one of these hardened criminals. After one continued to harass Jesus, mockingly demanding that he save himself and them, verse 40 tells us that one of the criminals rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." You see, this man has come to a realization. He's had a eureka moment. He realizes that there's something different about Jesus, something that sets him apart. Their own sentence, he declares, is just, at least within the paradigm of the Roman system of justice. They are getting what they deserved. But Jesus was special. And in our growth groups this week, we'll be reminded that these men were very much unlike Jesus. And Kyle takes some time to hypothesize what may have been happening in the life of this criminal. And what's interesting as I've been studying this week is that we often call them the thieves that were crucified with Jesus. And I looked through several translations, and there's one or two that refer to them as robbers. But if you get down into the Greek of it, which I've said before, I don't do a whole lot, but for some reason I've been finding myself in like reading Greek, which I don't understand, but there's this website, for those of you who are interested, called Blue Letter Bible, that actually takes, and for each word or phrase, because the New Testament was written in Greek, and so it actually takes each word in a couple of translations, the King James and the New American Standard, and actually gives you what the Greek translation was, and includes what's called the Strong's Concordance, which defines these Greek words and gives you kind of a deeper dive into what these mean in the context of it and kind of illuminates it a little better. And so when you look at what this word means, it actually just simply means criminal or wrongdoer in the Greek. It's actually unlikely these men were guilty of stealing, because the Romans, yes, they executed thieves, sure, but they tried to get rid of thieves quickly. They were pretty low on the level of needing to make an example of them, unless it was a particularly heinous robbery. These men were typically executed quickly. Crucifixion was reserved for specific enemies of the state. Crimes of violence, crimes against women and children, but particularly crimes that could be classified as high treason against the empire. Typically, revolutionaries were the ones who were crucified. Remember, this was not just any death. Crucifixion was designed as a means to show the people if you do this, this will be you. And it was saved for the worst kind of people. So these criminals were most likely violent. He probably abandoned his family and friends. The teachings that he had been raised on were long since ignored. And through a series of his own choices, he has now come face to face with the most brutal death known to history. And suddenly, in a moment or in hours of self-reflection, maybe for the first time in his life, he realizes exactly who he is and what he deserves. He is a criminal, a sinner, facing the just punishment for his crimes, undeserving of what he was about to ask, but willing to ask for it anyways. Verse 42 tells us, "Then he said, 'Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' And he replied, 'Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise.'" Here's a man completely undeserving, quite beyond hope. He had not only been condemned, but his execution was underway. As he struggled under the weight of his body that pulled on the spikes through his hands and pushed on the spikes through his feet, as he struggled to find the strength to pull himself up, to take a breath, as he realized, and maybe his whole life is flashing before his eyes, as he knows that this is his final day because it is the Friday, not only before the Sabbath, which was a holy day to those in Israel, but this was the Friday before the Passover Sabbath, the most holy day in the year for a Jewish person. He knew he would die by sundown. And as he takes stock of his life, he knows that he is unworthy. He knows that he has brought this on himself. He knows he's getting what he deserves. He's reaping what he sowed. And you would be well within your rights to look at a man like this and say that he doesn't deserve what Jesus offered him. Condemned for his crimes against society, he deserved the punishment that he received. He deserved no mercy, and the state, the soldiers, and the crowd would offer none. For this man, his story was a story of failure, a story of loss, and a story that would end in tragedy, or so it seemed. But the beauty of this story that continues to resonate throughout history says that even though the world has told you it is too late for you, even when you look in the mirror and convince yourself that your crimes or your mistakes or your sins are your identity now, this is who you are, even when you think that there's no coming back from this and that you are doomed or even damned to be this person forever, that there is still hope. When everything seems lost, hope lives on, because there is nothing that we can do and nowhere that we can run to escape the hope that God brings. This man, this condemned man undergoing execution alongside Jesus, reminds us that our story can change. That even though his story up until this point had been one of failure and of violence, that it did not have to end the way it seemed as though it would. His story could change, and so can yours. Many of you are familiar with my own family's story. It seems appropriate that almost a year to the day that I first shared the story of my brother Jacob, that I bring a bit of an update. Jacob is my second to youngest brother. He's 20 years old. A year ago, was arrested for attempted robbery and assault. In the middle of the night, he was guilty. He was arrested, convicted, and sentenced. There was no denying that his sentence was just. He deserved what he got. In fact, he could have had 5 to 10 years if they had really fought for it, knowing that he was guilty. He was 19 at the time, but he's turned 20 since he's been in prison. Jacob, this boy that I barely remember him as a man. In fact, we went home last February to visit before this all went down, and I honestly didn't recognize my brother. It had been so long since I had seen him. I remember him as a tween. I don't remember him as a man. And so it's particularly hard for me to think about how his story has turned out. Well, since all of this, he was given a 3-year sentence in Canada. You are eligible for parole after 1/3 of your sentence has been served. And so he was eligible for parole as of this week. And on Tuesday, he was granted parole. He's to be released to a halfway house on Wednesday. But even despite this undoubtedly positive turn of events for him, that he is to be released back into society and that he has a chance to make good on his freedom, my concern for him is that society, and Canada is not entirely unlike America, society will look at ex-convicts and still judge them based on how they've lived, based on their mistakes, based on their failures, based on the crime that they committed, even if it's one crime one time. And my concern for Jacob is that he will buy into the lie that this is who he is, that this is all that he is. And I remember telling my mother when this all was first going down, because of course her reaction was, he's thrown his life away. His whole life is ruined because of this event. And I said, that is categorically untrue. Because the world may say that Jacob's life is ruined, that he has wasted his life now because of this decision that he made. And make no mistake, it was a decision he made. He wasn't coerced into it. This was nobody else's fault. He is not a martyr. He is not a victim. But I did say, and I will say, and I have told him as such, that you don't have to define your story based on your crimes, based on your past. And maybe you're here and you're like my brother. Maybe you haven't committed a crime. I hope for your sake that you haven't, just because life is a little easier when you don't. And yeah, Jacob's life is about to get harder than it was a year ago. But the same is true for you as it is for him. Your life doesn't have to be defined by your past. And too many of us, too many times, we've maybe not committed a crime, and maybe we haven't even committed a life-changing action or made a life-changing mistake. Maybe for you, you're more like me, that you've made a series of errors and a series of choices that have led to the way that your life is now. But you look at your life and it's still the story that you tell yourself. The story of failure, the story of worthlessness, the story of brokenness, the story that nobody could love you. And perhaps in your mind, that's how you would define yourself. Maybe you wouldn't tell somebody about this. Maybe if I asked you to use one word to describe your life, you would dig deep and find a positive to describe it. But maybe in your heart of hearts, maybe when you're alone in your room at night, you might choose a different tune. Maybe failure and unloved and broken is how you would define your story. Maybe that's your life right now. But the story that Jesus tells is another story altogether. It sounds quite different from the story we often tell ourselves, and it's different than the world tells you. In fact, the story that sometimes I even struggle now to believe is a story of hope. It's a story of restoration. It's a story of forgiveness. It's a story that says that you can change and that your life can change. This week, I've been spending a lot of time, obviously, studying this passage of Scripture from Luke 23. But God has been bringing my mind back to another passage, another story of hope that I think really resonates. In fact, two texts that are completely unrelated, two books that I was reading that kind of deal with this, at least have segments dealing with this story of the penitent criminal, brought me back to the story that Jesus told in Luke 15. And if you have your Bibles, why don't you turn back to Luke 15 to hear this story with me. It's one of Jesus' more famous parables. And it also tells a story of another young man who was guilty, who committed a grave injustice and who believed there was no going back for him. It's a story of a man who, through a series of his own choices, changed his life entirely. And it's from the book of Luke, chapter 15. And the story begins quite simply. Jesus says there is a man who had two sons. There's no other background given. We know very little. He doesn't even give names. Jesus' stories are often like that. But let's pick up reading. The verses will be on the overhead, but you probably know the story if you've been in church for any amount of time. It goes like this. It says, "The younger son told his father, 'I want my share of your estate now before you die.' So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. And a few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land where he wasted all his money in wild living. And about that time, his money ran out. A great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him. The man sent him into the fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything." I want to pause there for a moment. One of the interesting elements of Scripture is that we often treat it as if it's a book written for us. And in a sense, it is. The Bible is timeless, and the truths that it teaches are universal and timeless, but it was also written for a specific people at a specific time. And so sometimes we miss just how foundational some of the words are, or the shocking nature of some of the words that Jesus said. And I want to kind of back up to the son's statement to the father when he said, "I want my share of the estate now before you die." Now that sounds super selfish to me, and it is. But in Jesus' time, in first century Israel, if you were to demand of your father to give you your share of the inheritance now, it was more than just a statement of greed. To say to your father or your mother or your parents, "I want my inheritance now," was to say, "I wish you were dead." In fact, it basically is saying, "You are dead to me. I want nothing to do with you. Our relationship is over. I will never speak to you again. You might as well go crawl in a hole and die." That is something I've never actually said to my parents. My mother will tell you I've said many terrible things to her, but I've never actively wished that she would die, or have I told her as much. But we see here that not only is the son guilty of essentially stealing from his father, but he has severed any relationship that he could have had. In many senses of the term, the son is telling his father to go to hell. That is the shocking nature of what is being said here. So grab onto that shocking level, that shocking statement that the son made. The crowd would have understood how extreme the son's actions had been at this point. So it makes the father's actions even more shocking. His willingness to acquiesce to his son's demands, though he was under no obligation to do so. He did not have to agree to his son's terms, but he chose to do it anyways. He chose to give his son the freedom he demanded and paid the price that he required. And he let his son go freely. He did not force him to stay. So unsurprisingly, the son goes away, and as kids tend to do, he makes stupid decisions, and he finds himself with no money. And he finds himself alone with no place to stay and no friends to help him. There is something about running out of money that reveals who your real friends are. Whether you are a teenager, a young adult, or toward the end of your life, there is something about hard times that reveal your true friends. And this young man, we don't know how old he is, but we find that he discovers who his true friends are very quickly. But this young man in a foreign land with no money and no friends and no place to stay and no food becomes desperate and starts looking for a job. But even the job that he can find pays him little, so little that he can barely afford to eat. And he is said to have been starving to death, so much so that he looks at the pig slop and says, I'd like to get some of that in my mouth. Something that I don't know that anyone has ever said in the history of humanity that aren't starving. I've seen what pigs eat. It is less than ideal. He had at this point really lost all hope. There was nothing and no place for him. And the only respite that he could think of, the only thing that he could think that might save him from dying of starvation is maybe, just maybe, his dad would let him come home, not as family because he burnt that bridge, but maybe, just maybe, his dad would let him come home as a servant. He never in a million years even hoped that his dad could ever love him again. To him, this was his story. His story was one who was separated from his family. His story was one of his failures. His story was the one that took his inheritance and blew it all on parties and wild living and sexual encounters. And what did he have to show for it? Nothing except pain. Everything that he had was lost. And at this point, he felt quite alone and hopeless. And scripture says that it was at this time that he came to his senses and decided that he would, in fact, go home. And so he began to practice a speech that he would give to his father. And it went like this. He said, "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. The choices that I've made, the places that I've gone, the people that I've hurt, I am no longer worthy. But maybe there was a chance. Maybe there was a chance." But he never in a million years thought that he would find his family again, that he would find forgiveness. And maybe that's where you are. Maybe you have been wrestling with the question of now what? Where do I go from here? How do I come back from this? You may be trying to make sense of the choices that you've made, and you may not be able to see a light at the end of the tunnel. Many of us, we lay in our beds late at night, wide awake, and thinking to ourselves, wondering if there was any hope, asking if there's any coming back, questioning if there could ever be redemption for me, if there could ever be hope. And even in this story, we are not so unlike this son that sees no hope for restored relationship and sees no opportunity for forgiveness. So he begins to go home and he practices this speech. "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." And I picture him on the road home saying this over and over and over again, hoping that he appeared desperate and pathetic enough that his father would give him a job. But scripture tells us that something different happened We'll pick up reading in verse 20. It says, "So he returned home to his father. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced and kissed him. And his son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But his father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. Kill the fattened calf. We must celebrate with a feast, for the son of mine who was dead and is now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found.' So the party began." The beauty of this story is found in the heart of the father. The son, no doubt, played out every worst-case scenario imaginable. After he began to come home, he must have thought, what if my father won't even speak to me? That would serve me right. What if the father decides to take revenge and punish me? Again, I would deserve it. He probably had to compose himself out of fear every time he was overcome by these worst-case scenarios, never dreaming that the father would act the way that he did. But each time as he thought of these worst-case scenarios, he realized that even the worst-case scenario of going home would be better than his life now. And so even though he didn't deserve it, he decided that he had to go, and he had to try. And then picture the father. One of the things that always, always gets me is when Jesus said, "While the son was still a long ways off." Because you don't see somebody coming from a long way off unless you're looking for somebody to come from a long way off. Picture the father looking and waiting and hoping, seeing maybe, is this my son coming over the horizon? Picture him waiting day after day, hoping, praying that his son would return. Picture the father running out on the road to meet his son, and picture him throwing his arms around him, kissing him. Picture the joy on the face of the father as his tears of mourning turn to tears of joy. Listen to the son start to say his rehearsed speech, saying, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father isn't even listening, because he's already yelling to a servant, "Go and get this boy some clothes. Go get him sandals for his feet. Go get him a ring." And this is what's amazing, is that a ring on your finger was not for a servant or a friend, but the ring on your finger was for family. This boy who was dirty and disgusting and sweaty and hungry and gross, the father didn't care. The father embraced the stinky, smelly, dirty son that had spent months or even years partying and then living in his own filth, and now had come all of this way and probably hadn't bathed in a while. Maybe he smelled like the farm. But this father didn't see any of this. His father looked past the dirt and past the filth and past the stench, and he threw his arms around him. And he said, "My son who was dead is alive again." The son just wasn't gone and returned. The son was dead and is alive. This was a miracle. And that's the beauty of what God does for each and every one of us. Because the story of the prodigal son, the story even of the penitent criminal, is the story of each and every one of us. For those of us who might say that we've never strayed that far, let me just take a moment for those of us that maybe we grew up in the church and we always have been good people. understand that this is still our story. You maybe have just convinced yourself that you don't really have anything to apologize for. But understand that we are our own prodigals in need of a father who loves us. And for the rest of us that know, we know that we've strayed, we know that we've messed up, and we know and we see that when we stray, when we betray the God that loves us, when we denounce any and all affiliation to him, we see here a reminder that God will never abandon us. He will never look on us with anything but unfailing love. Even when we are faithless, God is faithful. He isn't concerned about whether we deserve his love or his faithfulness. He is simply faithful. The son had severed his relationship to the father, hurting his estate and even more his heart. The son abandoned his responsibilities, abandoned his brother, abandoned his home. And for what? He blew all his money. He had nothing to show for it. And the truth was that the son was absolutely right when he started his speech saying, "I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But that's the thing about forgiveness. It doesn't minimize what he did. It doesn't minimize his guilt. And even with my brother, I talked to him the week that he was arrested. And I told him, I said, "This is not about whether or not you're guilty. You and I know that you are. This is about the love of God that is so much greater than your guilt that it doesn't matter how guilty you are. His faithfulness, his forgiveness is mercy in the face of your sin. It doesn't discount it. It raises you up." Psalm 103, verse 8 reminds us that the Lord is compassionate and merciful, slow to get angry and filled with unfailing love. The story of the prodigal son reminds us that God did not come to save us based on our merits. He did not come for those that believe they've done enough or are good enough. He did not come for the best of the best. But Jesus himself said that he came to seek and to save the lost. Those who are hurt. Those who have wronged him. Those who have made choices that haunt them. Those are the ones that are closest to his heart. And remember that Jesus, even when he was brutally beaten, mocked, and crucified, cried, "Father, forgive them." God is a merciful God, even in the face of incredible wrongdoing. And that's what makes grace so amazing. Grace is amazing because it raises us up. Not that it lowers the bar, but that it raises us up to meet him because he already did the work necessary. Grace offers us what we could never earn, and mercy spares us from what we did earn. Forgiveness doesn't discount or minimize our guilt. It forgives us in face of our guilt, and that's what is amazing. God came to offer forgiveness because he loves us too much to see us perish. He could have condemned us, and he would have been right in that decision, but he chose a different path. He chose to show us simply how far he would go to bring us home. And let me share this truth with you today, especially if you're here and maybe you're struggling with some of this feeling of guilt and hopelessness. Maybe you look at your life and you think you're beyond repair. Maybe you look at yourself and you think that your life is too dark and too hopeless and you've done too much and gone too far. I need you to know that our God is a God who restores. He's the God of new things. And with Christ, your future is bright. Today can be a new day, a day not defined by defeat or failures or pain. It doesn't have to be defined by the choices that you made or even the choices that you're making. But because God is a God of new things, he has promised you hope and a future. There is joy and peace. Jeremiah 30, verse 17, I love this. He says, I will restore you to health and heal your wounds, declares the Lord. Now, this is spoken by a prophet in the midst of Israel. God's people had been generationally moving away and betraying God and sinning against him. And Jeremiah was a prophet in the midst of what's called the exile, which is a season of judgment against Israel because they were so defiant against God. And he's saying, if you turn to me, if you let me in, if you just turn away from the way that you're living and just come home, I will restore you. I will heal your wounds. I will make you whole again. I will make you mine. Because even for Israel, that was pretty terrible. There's a whole history there that you can dive into pretty deeply of how terribly Israel betrayed God and denied him with their actions. Even in spite of all of that, God said, if you turn to me, I will restore your health. I will heal your wounds. Today, maybe you feel like everyone has given up on you. Maybe you feel like the world has turned its back on you. Maybe even your own family looks down on you. No matter how bad things are, no matter how bad the choices that you've made, your life is not beyond restoration. Your situation is not your destination. No matter how hard it looks, God will never give up on you. God is not like people. He will bring us through the pain, and he will stick with us even when we deny him. So this morning, let's go back to the story of the prodigal son. In this moment, as the son was embraced by the father, and the father began to prepare this feast, this party for his son who was alive again, the son had to make a choice. The son had to choose whose story he would believe. Would he believe his own story of failure? His own story that was beyond hope? Would he believe that he was beyond saving? Or would he embrace the story of his father that said, my son who was dead is alive again? The son that once told me to drop dead is back home. And he had to choose which story he'd place his trust in, which story he would live his life by. And the answer to that question would change his life forever. And even the story of the criminal on the cross, yes, he was about to die, but understand his story fundamentally changed when he placed his trust in the story that Jesus was telling. And so the question for us is the question that the boy faced when he came home, and it's the question that the criminal faced on the cross. Whose story are you going to believe? Jesus longs for you to trust his story. He longs for you to come home and experience the story that he has for you. The story of hope. The story that says, my life can change. I'm going to ask if the worship team will come back up. We're going to close our service together with a time of worship. And as we do that, I want to again invite you. It's been kind of this theme of this series that has been bringing me back again and again and again to invitation. To inviting you to join the story that God has for you. And even though you may have run far from him, even though your whole life may have been about failures and about the messed up choices that you've made, and trust me, I get that. I've known more than my fair share of people who don't remember a life before their mistakes and before their failures and before the way that they have lived their life now. They don't even remember anything else. But Jesus, in the story of the criminal on the cross, and Jesus in the story of the lost son, the dead son who came back to life, is a story that says it doesn't matter what you've done, it doesn't matter where you've gone, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter how bad you've messed up, you can always come home. I made the statement last week, and I'll say it again because it's worth repeating. It doesn't matter how far you run from God. It doesn't matter how far you go. You are always only one step away from coming home. So maybe you're here and you've been running. Maybe you're like the son and you've had that relationship with the Father, but you've been running away and you've been pushing him back and you said, you know, leave me alone, go away. Know that your life doesn't have to be defined by those choices anymore. That the Father is waiting and looking and hoping and praying for you to return. And maybe you've never had a relationship with this God. Maybe your whole life has been defined by the choices you've made, and you don't know what life is like with hope and love and forgiveness and mercy. Well, let me tell you about a God that loves you. Let me tell you about a God that gave everything for you. Today can be the day that you experience that new life, that you can be that son who was dead and is alive again, that you can find hope, that you can find home, that you can find family. And it could be today for you. Your life can change here and now. So we're going to sing this song. It's called Came to My Rescue. It's one of my favorite songs to sing together as a congregation. I would give you a couple of, I guess, words of instruction. The altars are always open. These front steps are padded if you want to come and pray. If you don't want to try to kneel, you can stand. You can sit in one of the empty seats. Often the posture that we take impacts the way that we interact with God. And so sometimes kneeling just is a way of surrendering to God. You could stay where you're at. There's nothing magical about this, but for some of us, that's just such a massive shift in our own mental thinking. But as we sing, my hope for you is that you would decide as we sing, and maybe you need to be praying while we sing, so you can stay seated if you want, you can stand if you want, however you need to interact with God. But following the singing, we're going to have a short time of prayer, and we're going to have, again, an opportunity for you to make a choice, to choose whose story you're going to believe.